Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Tuesday, December 27th, 2016. Several opposition politicians arrested in Khartoum last month have been freed, but the government denies it violated anyone's free speech rights.
We all agree that the authority should be changed through peaceful means and through democracy, and not through any sort of violence.
And South Sudanese teachers working in Ugandan resettlement camps get trained on how to deal with children suffering from trauma.
We try to train them, to make them aware that trauma healing is actually with living in house, and we try to eliminate and take it out step by step.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudan's Minister of Information has confirmed that the government has freed a number of opposition politicians detained since last month for taking part in a protest against a 30% increase in fuel prices. The Sudanese Congress Party says 16 of its members were released, while the Future Forces for Change Party said 4 of its members were also let go. Sudan's National Security Act gives national intelligence agents broad powers, including preventive detention. Information Minister Ahmed Bilal denies the government is suppressing free speech by arresting the protesters, saying the politicians were arrested because they want to bring about a change of government through violent demonstrations.
Actually, they were detained because, you know, we as Sudanese, we agreed that all of us to the constitution and the national security are fine. That we all agree that the authority should be changed through peaceful means and through democracy, and not through any sort of violence or weapon. And everybody agrees on that. We have got a free hand to move or to make their conferences, they make their ideas, everything. But those who are detained, they want to topple off the regime through violence, through demonstration, through other means, with allies, with those who are holding the arms and so forth. That's why they were detained. I hope they all agree what our people agreed upon, that the change or the transference of power should be through election and not anything else.
But, Mr. Minister, those released were arrested because they were protesting. And so people say perhaps your government should allow people the freedom to protest.
No. If it's just a protest or demonstration, there is no problem. But they are arrested because they are calling for toppling the regime through civil disobedience and demonstrations. And also they were allied with the those who are holding the arms. That's why they were detained. Others who are not doing this, they are free to talk, they are free to share their opinion, and nobody arrested them.
Mr. Minister, where are we in the protest now? The doctor strike, the protest against the fuel prices, the increase in the fuel price. Is everything okay?
Absolutely. They tried this twice. They call for civil disobedience, and it failed. There is no response. The people want now the change which we have reached through the national dialogue. Next month, we are going to constitute the new government, which is going to shoulder the implementation of our recommendations. And all others, we are going to join this. And there are also the negotiations with the movements holding arms. And the margin of freedom, it can be actually extended more and more if all we agree, and that through elections and through democratic means, the change can happen. And they have a chance to do. And now we have other African countries where the governing parties have failed and the governing presidents have failed, and through democracy, a change happened. Why should we call for a change through civil disobedience or demonstrations and violence and war?
In the coming year, 2017, tell me, what does President Omar Bashir, what message does he have for the people of Sudan? A message of peace, a message of political reconciliation. What message does he have?
Actually, reconciliation. This is the message he has. And I think the greatest thing that has been done so far is the national dialogue. And Bashir is going to again change or to run for presidency. This is, I can't tell, because I'm not one of his party. This is the NCT, they can decide which or not. But I'm sure a great job has been done. We are so optimistic that 1917 and all Sudanese are looking forward for a big change.
One concern that people have is your government or your security forces always trying to confiscate print of newspapers because they have published something that the government doesn't like. People say that is not in line with democratic values.
Actually, the confiscation doesn't happen because of or the opposition. Not only this. You know, sometimes these papers can do which can damage the national security, whether it is in the community, whether it is financial, or in the arms. So this is what they do for the confiscation and for that. And I repeat what I said already, because they are calling for other means of democracy. Other means like what happened in Egypt, that through demonstration and then the violence happened and then they changed. And that's why for us, we are not happy that this should happen. But if we all agree about the political means, like any other country in the world, nobody can actually confiscate or do what the people here have an opinion, whether it is with or against the government.
Mr. Minister, thank you very much. I just wish you the best and happy 2017. Happy New Year to you and your family.
Thank you very much. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
That's Sudan Information Minister Ahmed Bilal speaking with VOA's James Buddy from Khartoum earlier today. There are reports that Republic of Congo President Denis Sassou plans to meet today with the U.S. President-elect Donald Trump to talk about the ongoing political turmoil in Libya and other African issues. Sassou spokesman Thierry Mungala says in a Twitter posting that the two are expected to discuss ways to end the Libyan crisis, as well as other challenges affecting the continent, according to a statement attached to the tweet. Sassou did not elaborate on the meeting details. Representatives for Trump's team have not confirmed the meeting with the Republican president-elect, who will succeed President Barack Obama on January 20th. Trump is spending the week at his resort in southern Florida. Libya has been dealing with continuing political upheaval as rival governments split the nation's east and west, and other armed militias have also competed for power. Earlier in December, the United Nations pointed ongoing human rights violations affecting migrants in Libya. Trump has been holding meetings at his property in Palm Beach, as well as Trump Tower in New York City, while preparing to become the next U.S. president. Trump has never held elective office before. In Uganda, dozens of South Sudanese primary and secondary school teachers working in refugee camps in the Thebe northern part of the country have been trained on how to help children suffering from trauma because of what they've witnessed during the conflict. The Presbyterian Church of Sudan and South Sudan sponsored the training at a refugee settlement camp in Uganda's Kiryandongo district. As we hear from Bonifacio Taban, who recently visited the camp and has this report for VOA from Kampala.
Reverend Stephen Young is the education director at the Presbyterian Church of Sudan and South Sudan, who facilitated last week training at the Biala Refugees Resettlement Camp. Young said many South Sudanese suffer from trauma following the outbreak of fighting in December 2013, which has dragged on for 3 long years.
Our objectives train the teachers is to equip them with the knowledge so that they will be able to train our young children who are in whole countries, especially our neighboring countries where our people, South Sudanese, dispatch into all those areas, and we do follow them. We want to train them so that they will be able to train the children.
With violence still raging in South Sudan, Nyang said he expects more South Sudanese will flee into Uganda and other neighboring countries. Many South Sudanese children will cross into neighboring countries, especially those who have lost their parents or have been sexually abused during the conflict, are traumatized, according to Nyang. South Sudanese refugees James McIntyre, who live at Viala Settlement Camp, said people who lost close relatives in the camp are traumatized by what they saw. Nyang said some of the children are mentally unstable, while others are physically violent, one of the signs of being traumatized. Nyang said the Presbyterian of Sudan and South Sudan believe that both teachers and students need help dealing with trauma they have been experiencing back home.
We try to train them, to make them aware that trauma healing is actually with living in house, and we try to eliminate and take it out step by step so that they will understand and they come to their sense.
Nyang said the teachers were taught teaching skill, counseling skill, and project proposal writing skills. Liet Machuat is a volunteer teacher from Rhino Camp in Uganda Western Region. She said some people who fled the conflict have lost trust in others' community and perceive members of others' ethnic group as enemies.
You know, the community that we are in, these are the community that is coming from the country we is now in war. They lost everything. So for them, when they come here also, you can see someone but is traumatized. And this teaching also is helpful.
Guy Queenin said he advised children to look at themselves as South Sudanese national rather than being members of a particular ethnic group or tribe.
It is not the Dinkas and the Nuer, it is only the political leadership. So I tell them, leave those things, and then let us build the new courage to you, because one day, one time, you may be a leader which has the capacity. And I encourage them to have a national interest, not the tribe.
Reverend Nyang said religious leaders in South Sudan have faced hardship from the local politicians in the country, despite several attempts by church leaders to mediate peace in South Sudan.
So the church is having a very, very big challenge, because our politicians are not hearing the church well, are not hearing the voice of the church. We have many sectors for peace. The churches are actually doing also their works, conduct the rallies and conferences, marching on the road, talking about peace. But yet our leaders are not listening the voice of the church.
This is the third training the Presbyterian Church of Sudan and South Sudan has conducted in the region, following similar training in Sudan, Ethiopia, and Kenya, with the hope of helping victims of violence heal from their trauma and they eventually lead productive life. For BOA News, I'm Bonifacio Teban, reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
War, university studies abroad, and work has dispersed many South Sudanese to different places across the globe. Many young people say they would prefer to use social media to communicate with their relatives and friends back home, but say the older generation is usually not connected. Mugume Davis Wakarinj has this report for VOA from Kampala.
20-year-old Paulina Matiop, a senior six student at Kompe Senior Secondary School in Uganda, says he has not returned home to his native East Nile state since 2013 due to the ongoing conflict. Matiop says his relatives live in the United States and other parts of Africa, so the cheapest way to stay connected is social media.
Sometimes it's not easy to communicate with phones, but sometimes use Facebook to do that.
But he says his father and mother, who now live in Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, do not know how to use Facebook. He has to call them, but it's very expensive to talk by phone. Sometimes he sends letters along with some acquaintances traveling to Juba to give to his relatives. Another person who would prefer to use social media to keep in touch with her relatives is 29-year-old Sarah David, a single mother who works in a restaurant in Kampala. Sarah says she primarily uses her cell phone to communicate with her family back home, but sometimes gets on Facebook.
Sometimes Facebook, we are talking together on Facebook, just chatting. Even my father is there from Khartoum, chatting also, just talking with the phone. But it's not some minute, just a minute only, because talking there is too much taking money. When you put 5,000, they just finish. I was like 3 minutes only.
Onyango Madit, a student at Makerere University in Uganda, says he too uses social media and phone calls to stay in touch with his people. He says he also pays 5,000 Ugandan shillings, or about $1.50, to talk to his parents in Juba for 1 minute. So he doesn't call very often. In 2014, East African countries, including South Sudan, signed what they called One Network, which was aimed at reducing call tariffs. The network also allows people to use roaming with their phones without incurring extra charges. But for friends and relatives who live in US and Europe, Madit says keeping in touch is a bit easier.
Struggle a lot to talk back to the people at home, and it's hard and it's expensive to us too. I just use Facebook like Messenger, not video call, but just through text.
Speaking by phone from Nairobi, Kenya, where he's visiting relatives, Kwanyi Dao Dao says he keeps in touch with his family on Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp, and other new social media apps.
Through social media, that is normal communication. Others, we make normal phone calls.
Dao Dao says sometimes he writes handwritten letters, as his family did a generation ago, and sends them home through friends. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Kigali, Rwanda.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Is there a connection between heart attacks and being HIV positive? Find out when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan, or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the first thing you look for when you come home?
When I come back home, I see the people at home, if they are fine or not. And second thing, I see my mom, if they finish the work or not. If they want to sweep the room and everything that, if no any work, I just sit with my mom.
Yes, I first have to eat after, and then I see what exactly happened at home in my absence. Then after, I look into the book.
When I reach at home, I first to remove my clothes away and I'm looking for my food. Because I'm come there, I'm too hungry. I will look for my food and I eat and I take something to do.
Well, when I come back home from the school, the first thing I can remove out my clothes, then I look for the lunch, then after food, I can take rest for a while.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we are talking about heart attacks and the HIV virus. While much progress has been made in treating people infected with the AIDS virus, new research shows they faced other health risks. A new study says HIV-positive people have a much higher risk for heart attacks than those who are not infected. Researchers say the information could lead to better medical care for those living with HIV. Dr. Matthew Feinstein is a cardiovascular disease fellow at Northwestern University. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
HIV is an excellent example of really evolving epidemiology and competing risks for different sorts of diseases, especially in higher income countries and places where there's access to effective therapy for HIV, has really evolved from a generally fatal disease to what's really essentially a controllable chronic disease. But as we're learning, it's one marked by chronic inflammation and chronic immune activation. So the question is, if people are no longer dying as often from AIDS-related illnesses or opportunistic infections, what else is replacing them if there is still some morbidity associated with HIV?
So after your research, what did you find about the heart attack risk for those who are HIV positive?
the percent of deaths that are due to heart disease over the last 15 years. It's almost tripled in terms of the proportion of people with HIV who die from cardiovascular diseases. So that made us want to see how good the general models we use to estimate heart disease risk in the general population, how well do they work in HIV, thinking that they may not work that well because maybe their heart attack and stroke risk is significantly higher. We use the risk estimator, which is really used in the general population, and it's used in U.S. in cardiology clinics and actually in primary care clinics quite a bit to understand what are people's 10-year and lifetime risks for heart disease. So we use that, and we applied it to this large cohort of HIV-infected individuals, and we ended up finding that the risk predictor was significantly underpredicting risk for heart attack in the HIV-infected people, and because their risk for heart attack are substantially higher than in the general population.
Is this the same for those who are on treatment as well as those who are not on treatment?
Certainly being treated for HIV, it's obviously better than not being treated for HIV, but it is also better for heart disease risks. That said, there is still residual risk for heart attack and stroke, and actually for other heart-related morbidities and mortality causes such as heart failure. There is still that residual risk even when you're treated for HIV. And in fact, in this cohort, the vast majority of participants were taking antiretroviral therapy. They were all engaged in regular clinical care at HIV care sites. And despite that engagement in care, there was still this elevated risk for heart attack.
About a year or so ago, I remember doing an interview regarding HIV and lifespan, and they found that people who are HIV positive could have shorter lifespans because their immune system has been so active for so many years. Is that related to what you found? Because you did mention inflammation.
The short answer is yes. a little bit of a longer answer, really what we think is going on is that there's this chronic inflammation and immune activation in the setting of HIV. And even when the virus is undetectable in the blood, there's still this low-level viral replication in the tissues that drives global and even vascular, most likely, inflammation, immune activation. And why does that matter for this? That immune activation, that inflammation can lead to the development of plaques in the arteries, and those plaques can become unstable. When those plaques become unstable, they rupture, and that's a heart attack, that's a stroke.
And this doesn't matter what the person's age is or race or gender?
Certainly in the general population, the older you get, the higher your risk for heart attack or stroke. And certainly that's true in an absolute sense in HIV. If you're 70 years old and have HIV, your risk for heart attack is certainly higher than if you're 35 years old and you have HIV. That said, there is an accelerated risk. So there have been some really nice studies using imaging to evaluate atherosclerosis, the buildup of plaque in the arteries in the heart and near the heart. And they've seen that HIV-infected people tend to build up this plaque about 10 to 15 years earlier than uninfected people, even when they're well treated.
So now that you have this information, can you make any recommendations or do you need to do further study?
Certainly we need to do a lot of further study. That's the first and most important point here. Because what we found is that our existing risk estimators aren't that good. And that even when we tried adding some HIV-related variables in here, it didn't really improve how well we did at predicting someone's risk of heart attack or stroke. That said, the one thing we've found pretty consistently here is that there's underprediction. What you can, I think, pretty safely say now is their risk for a heart attack or stroke in the next 10 years is at least 10%. It could be quite a bit higher, but it's at least that. Having a sense of what the risk for heart attack or stroke is really so important to figuring out how we best prevent and then ultimately treat them.
That's Dr. Matthew Feinstein, a cardiovascular disease fellow at Northwestern University. He was speaking to VOA's Joe DiCapua. Somalia swore in new parliament members today, but is delaying its presidential election for a fourth time, which is expected to be delayed until early next year. Mohamed Yusuf has the story for VOA from Nairobi.
Tuesday's swearing-in ceremony in Mogadishu saw 281 members of the upper and lower houses of parliament take office. Independent regional analyst Abdul Wahab Sheikh Abdi Samad says this parliament is better than the previous one.
Today's event is a step forward in the right direction. Somalia now is going to a new era, the new chapter now. The new members of parliament, almost 45% of them are new, are former members of the parliament, while 55% of the members are new, very young people, energetic people, well-educated people. These new members of parliament, almost significant number of them are women, unlike other time.
Somalia could not hold direct nationwide elections due to ongoing insecurity and logistical issues. So the members of the upper and lower house were chosen by a selection of clan leaders and regional representatives. The president will then be elected by parliament. Critics say the process has been marred by vote-buying, violence and intimidation. The Electoral Commission says it is redoing the elections of 5 MP posts because of these irregularities. The Commission said at one point that it will redo 24 races, but then dropped the number back to 5. Other seats are still vacant as clan leaders have not yet decided on the candidates. The Somali Auditor General told the VOA Somali service earlier this month that some candidates were paying $5,000 to $30,000 to get elected to the parliament. In a joint media statement, the United Nations, African Union, European Union, Intergovernmental Authority on Development, Britain and the United States welcomed the inauguration of parliamentary representatives Tuesday, timing it a step forward. But the international community also expressed concerns about the last-minute decision to add 18 more seats to the upper house. Somalia's National Leadership Forum announced the additional seats on Saturday. The decision contradicts the constitution, which limits the upper house to 54 senators. Professor Mohamed Ali is the Chancellor of the Southern University in Baidoa. He says the reason why we are having delays is because the presidential candidates are interfering with the process and are making a decision based on how it is going to favour them. Paying salaries of 275 MPs is already hard. They've also created 54 seats of senators, and now they have added up to 18 more senators. It is not even clear what those people's roles will be. This is not sustainable, he says. Current President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud is a member of the National Leadership Forum. He's running for re-election against his 6 challengers. Parliament was scheduled to vote for the president on Wednesday, but Electoral Commission officials now tell the VOA Somali service that the vote has been postponed to January 24th. Though the commission has yet to confirm that date publicly. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's our show for this Tuesday. We leave you with the song Yala Kita Wutu by Victoria Ole.
Yala Kita Wutu, Yala Kita Wutu, Yala Yala, Yala Kita Wutu, Yala Kita Wutu, Yala. Kelly ni najere, yala ni najere, yala yala. Kelly ni najere, yala ni najere, yala yala. Ee, yala, oh yala yala. Ee, yala, oh yala yala. Alfa assalam, yala assalam, yala yala. Yala ya Sudan, yala ya Sudan.
We've been listening to Victoria Ole with the song Yala Kita Wutu. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. We hope you can be here tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. My people.